Hello, listeners. Will you allow me a minute to tell you about Past Test? If you haven't used them yet, you should. They are a fantastic online resource with hundreds of questions and answers covering multiple medical exams, including the MRCS, MRCP, and medical finals. I've used them lots and found the resource so useful, particularly the past papers for these exams. As a listener to the podcast, you lucky people get 15% off some of these subscriptions. So don't wait around. I mean, do until the end of the episode, but then go and get your access. Links and codes will be in the show notes. But before we get going, I'd also like to tell you about a really great resource that I've used for probably all my exams. It's Teach Me Surgery. It's a website covering all the topics you'd need to know. It's really easy to use and clear to follow. It goes through the topics in a logical and comprehensive manner and always finishes making it clinically relevant. Nearly all the content is free, and I'd highly recommend adding it to your regularly used resources. Please find the link in the bio and check it out. Welcome to MRCS on the Move, Bowels, Bones and Backseat Vibers. I'm your host, Naomi, but this is the podcast where you do the talking. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Bowels, Bones and Backseat Vibers. It is great to be back with you. I hope everyone is doing well and revision going smoothly as always. I am very excited today to have another special guest with me. I have a friend and colleague today who's come to speak about lung cancer. So welcome Dr. Alex Smith to the podcast. Alex is a respiratory trainee currently working in the Northwest. So hello.
Hi Naomi, how are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Are you excited? Nervous?
Nervous. Never done a podcast before. First experience, yeah. So nervous to put my name out there, but yeah, looking forward to being part of it.
Well, I'm sure you're great, or you'll do great. So we're probably just going to crack straight on with it. So I've got Alex on because obviously as a respiratory trainee, I'm hoping he knows a little bit about lung cancer.
Hopefully a little bit.
Looking forward to hearing your expertise. So we're going to kind of similar structure as always, run through epidemiology, some pathology, and then go into the more clinical side of things. So we'll start with if you guys could tell me what you know about the epidemiology of lung cancer.
So I guess when we talk about lung cancer, we generally mean bronchial carcinoma, which accounts for about 95% of all of the thoracic malignancies. And it's important to differentiate between that things like mesothelioma and carcinoid, which are separate. So we'll mainly be talking about bronchial carcinoma today. So it's the third most common cancer in the UK, and 13% of all new cancers diagnosed when it was last reported, which was about 2017 to 2019 from Cancer Research. 45,000 to 50,000 people are diagnosed with lung cancer every year in the UK. And one in 13 UK males and one in 15 females will be diagnosed with cancer in their lifetime, or lung cancer in their lifetime, sorry. It's the most common cause of cancer death in the UK. Sadly, 21% of all cancer deaths, which is roughly 30 to 35,000 deaths every year from lung cancer. However, on the plus side, mortality rates are projected to fall over the next 20 years by about 20%. And the jury's out entirely as to what is going to cause that. It's probably going to be a multitude of things, probably advancing treatments, earlier detection being the most common things. I know we're going to talk about those later in the podcast. One thing that I find quite interesting from work I've been doing recently as well, that your listeners might find interesting, is that the incidence rates in men and women are about 160 to 170% higher in the most deprived two deciles of the population compared to the least deprived two deciles. So sadly, it is a cancer of people who are worse off than others. And we know that anecdotally that's correct, but actually statistics prove it as well. Mm. So a lot of the stuff we're trying to do is targeting those people more than anyone. Mm.
Do they know why that is?
There's a multitude of factors to what we think caused that, mainly from people, the risk factors that cause lung cancer, and people being smokers more likely in those populations, and then also whether those people are likely to present to their GP or to a healthcare professional with symptoms. And some research I've done recently with a colleague has shown that people sadly in those lower deciles of deprivation are less likely to actually present to a healthcare practitioner, so less likely to present with early stage disease, less likely to present with treatable disease, unfortunately.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, so what are the two main pathological types of lung cancer? And we're just going to talk to the two that are probably relevant to surgeons, aren't we? So what are sort of the two main ones that we should be aware of?
So, yeah, when we talk about lung cancer, we talk about two main types based on their histopathological appearance under a microscope, and it's based on the size of the cells. So we talk about small cell lung cancer, non-small cell lung cancer. Small cell cancer accounts for 15 to 20% of cases, used to be known as oat cell cancer. It arises from the Kilchutsky cells of the apod system, and generally these ones that don't sadly make it to surgery, they're the ones that appear often late, often very aggressive and rapidly growing. And sadly, a lot of these people who present with small cell lung cancer are not surgical candidates. And the other classification is non-small cell lung cancer, which counts for the other proportion, 80 to 85% cases. And there is some subdivisions of there, such as adenocarcinoma, squamous cell and large cell cancer, and then some other smaller ones as well. But they're the two main categories.
Fabulous. I am going to take this opportunity to apologise again to the listeners, as I always do, for my dog in the background. but that's...
Another guest for the podcast name. Everyone's welcome.
She is not a welcome podcast most of the time. Not a welcome guest, I mean, most of the time. But there we go. Someone said, so I met someone earlier who listened to the podcast, one of the F1s. He was like, oh, you're Naomi from the podcast. And we eventually started talking about, well, we talked a bit more about it. And I was like, oh, so what's the name of my dog? And he was like, oh, I can't remember, but she's a Vizsla. I know that. I was like, oh, yeah. Didn't ask him any clinical questions, but he could remember the type of dog I have. Anyway, let's move on. Which cancers typically present centrally and which peripherally? A specific question, this one. Go on.
So generally, small cell lung cancers are the ones that present centrally, and as we mentioned before, they're the ones that are quite aggressive and not amenable to surgery. Some of the non-small cells can present centrally, such as squamous cell carcinoma as well. And then the most common presentation of the rest of the non-small cell lung cancers are in the upper lobes of the lungs, and that accounts for about 40% of cancer presentations.
Great. And which most commonly allows for surgical management?
Yeah, so as we mentioned before, the ones that are most commonly amenable to surgical management are the ones that are peripheral, and generally we talk about non-small cell lung cancer being the ones that are amenable to surgical management, but that obviously depends on lots of other things such as local and distant metastases and lymph node involvement as well as the patient as well, what they want, and the performance status, etc., which I know we're going to come to talk about.
Yeah. So what are the risk factors for bronchial carcinomas?
Yeah, so actually 79% of lung cancers in the UK are classed as preventable cancers, which is quite a high statistic. Yeah,
that's really high.
I don't think I quite appreciated the statistic until I looked at the incidence for this, all the statistics for this podcast. And we knew that a lot of it's smoking related, but we say that 79% of them are classed as preventable cancers. Obviously, the most common cause, as we all know, is smoking. That is the most common risk factor associated with it, and generally is attributed to causing 72% of lung cancers. After that, we say that about 13% of lung cancer cases are caused by workplace exposures, 8% caused by air pollution, and 5% caused by ionising radiation. But by far and away, the most common cause of lung cancer is smoking, which is obviously an easily modifiable risk factor and one that we can try and reduce over the next few years.
Do you think there is any, because obviously a lot less people smoke now, I think a lot less people smoke now than they used to, are you already seeing the effect of that, do you think, or not yet? I guess because the older population is still...
I don't think we are yet, because I think a lot, again, this is not quoting any research and purely anecdotal, but I think a lot of the people who are presenting with lung cancer, it is predominantly a disease of an older population still, who have smoked previously in their life and, for want of a better expression, done the damage already. You know, that cancer risk is already embedded in those patients, unfortunately. We know that the sooner you stop, the lower your chances, but you can't undo that smoking history for all those years, unfortunately.
So it is a cumulative effect, smoking.
So
slightly more clinical now. How can lung cancers present?
So there's a variety of ways in cancers lung cancer can present, and some of the symptoms can be really specific and some of them can be very vague. So the most common symptoms, and these form a lot of the NICE criteria for who we test for lung cancer, most commonly the symptoms are cough, followed by fatigue, breathlessness or shortness of breath, chest pains, weight loss and appetite loss. So actually anyone who is over the age of 40 and presents to their GP or any healthcare professional with those symptoms should be offered an urgent chest x-ray. And actually one of the other most important symptoms is unexplained hemoptysis. So anyone over the age of 40 who presents with unexplained hemoptysis should be urgently referred on a 2-week wait, regardless of chest x-ray findings. So they're the most common presenting symptoms, and obviously hemoptysis being the most concerning.
Okay, so what signs, when we're doing our very thorough respiratory examination, would we or might we find in someone who has an underlying lung cancer?
As mentioned, from the things that we can see in terms of presenting symptoms, some of the signs can be quite non-specific as well, which doesn't help the clinician who's doing the examination, but I think it's always useful being mindful with the clinical history and context. But we tend to worry when people have persistent or recurrent chest infections, so symptoms consistent with that, such as crepitations on the chest, constant purulent sputum, obviously, that's unexplained by other presentations or other underlying known diseases. Other things to think about are finger clubbing, which we know is a very non-specific sign that people have, but is often attributed to cancers, and lung cancer being one of those. And then some people can present with lymphadenopathy, so if you're worried about these patients, it's always important to do a thorough lymph node exam, looking at the supraclavicular and the cervical lymphadenopathy, because that can later go on to form part of your diagnostic workup as well. And then other chest signs that you worry about when you're auscultating the chest or otherwise tapping it is that you might find that someone's got crepitations, you might find signs consistent with atelectasis or collapse, and signs consistent with the pleural effusion, so, you know, reduced air entry and dullness to percussion. And then again, anyone who's above the age of 40 and has these persistent symptoms should have an urgent chest x-ray done as well.
Do you ever go straight to a... I might be jumping ahead of us. But I was going to ask, do you ever go straight to a CT in any of these situations, or is it always chest x-ray first?
In very rare instances, you may go straight to a CT, and you even may go straight to a CT, go straight to a CT in a normal x-ray with someone with persistent symptoms. So one of those might be if someone presents with unexplained hemoptysis, you may go straight to a CT if you're concerned that the patient has significant history, or if the patient's got prior history of having treated lung cancer and then you're worried about recurrence, you may do a straight to CT in those patients.
Yeah, okay. You know how much we love
CTs. Sort of
sorry, go on. I was going to say, you know how much we love CTs.
Yeah,
I know,
yeah. It's great to CT. It's a bit more down to clinician preference and, you know, clinical experience in those situations as to how worried you are, what your expectation is for cancer in those patients.
Yeah, it's a bit similar, or it makes me think of my like hematuria clinic where, you know, most people get an ultrasound, but then if they've got lots of risk factors or it's visible hematuria or something like that, then they'd get a CT. It's a similar principle.
Yeah.
But this isn't a urology podcast. okay. So what signs and symptoms might you find if there is a local invasion of a lung cancer?
Yeah, so local invasion can be tricky, and people can again present with symptoms that are not very specific, and some of the ones already mentioned are a result of local invasion. So we talk about lymphadenopathy, that's relatively local invasion, people can develop those signs. But then the things that I guess are important to be mindful of are the things like persistent hemoptysis. The local invasion, especially for some of the central lesions, can cause collapse and atelectasis, which causes breathlessness. And then when you're listening to the chest, you'd expect reduced air entry over the side where the central lesion is, because there's reduced air entry to that part of the lung, or sometimes even the entire lobe. And that's often caused by compression of one of the major airways or one of the main bronchi. If you've got a peripheral lesion that's invading locally, patients can present with chest pain over that side. And you do hear reports of that, people presenting with a persistent backache or an ache on their side, and then you scan them and you end up finding a peripheral lesion. Hmm. And then also, one that we all learnt about in medical school that seems to come up in all exams is hoarse voice caused by laryngeal nerve palsy from left-sided cancers. So
Horner's?
You can get that. Horner's, yeah, exactly. So Horner's is one of the syndromes that we'll talk about in a second, but you can get this hoarseness by the recurrent laryngeal nerve palsy caused by these left-sided cancers, which, as you guys as surgeons will know more than me, the anatomy of the chest, but it's caused by the compression of the recurrent laryngeal nerve, which takes a bit of a circuitous route through the chest. Mm-hmm.
So, what are paraneoplastic syndromes that you might find with a bronchial carcinoma? We talked about what paraneoplastic syndromes are in our last podcast, so we'll talk about how they... Now we'll think about how they relate to bronchial carcinoma. So go for it, audience. Now you, Alex.
So, there are some paraneoplastic syndromes that occur in lung cancer, not just lung cancer, but core and other things, but one of the things that you can see is Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome. So that's caused by interaction with voltage-gated calcium channels and causes the sort of classical signs of the proximal limb weakness, which, unlike myasthenia, Lambert-Eaton is predominant in the lower limbs. So you may hear patients talking about, I struggle walking up and down the stairs and struggling getting out of a chair because it's caused by that sort of proximal weakness affecting your large muscles of your legs. Mm. Other things, so that's commonly associated with small cell lung cancer. Another one associated with small cell is Cushing syndrome, so that's ectopic secretion of steroids, so you end up getting symptoms of increased steroid production, so Cushing's is often common in those patients. And then rarely you can get a cerebellar degeneration, which is a very, very rare complication, and sadly enough, don't see it very often just because of the advanced nature of a small cell cancer. People often present with symptoms of their malignancy rather than of the paraneoplastic syndrome. And then I guess with the other ones, such as some of the non-small cells, particularly the squamous, you get syndrome associated with hypercalcemia. And then also the Horner syndrome or Pankow syndrome, they talk about, caused by a Pankow's tumour, an apical lesion, which causes the classic symptoms of ptosis, meiosis and hydrosis. So that can cause that backwards game, squamous cell carcinoma.
Would SIADH count as one as well?
Yeah, SIADH is really common, actually. So well spotted that I missed that off my notes. SIADH is
the only one I know.
I know, yeah. It's the one everyone looks out for. So if someone comes in to hospital with symptoms concerning of a lung cancer, they've got low sodium, you're concerned about why that may be, they may be confused with syndrome from inappropriate antidiuretic hormone production, you can often test these people by doing things that I often get called as a medical registrar, how do we check for low sodium? And, you do things like checking urinary osmolalities and urinary sodium, and you just work your way through the flow charts to find the differential of SIADH. Yeah. A lot of these paraneoplastic syndromes are caused by the cancers that affect the endocrine system. So you often see them with small cells, which affects endocrine.
I hate sodium. I always have. So if you want to come back and do a podcast on sodium, you're welcome to.
I did a renal job when I was an SHO, and I had a very particular consultant who she said to me, go away and tell me, I want you to come back tomorrow and tell me all about sodium balance. And it was like the worst thing you could ever hear. Because I came back the next day with reams and reams of notes on how to assess sodium, and I feel like I've understood it a bit better since then. But I must admit, every time someone asks me how to assess for someone for low sodium, you do have to properly think about it, because there's all sorts of tests you end up having to do.
As many times as I look at it, I still would have to go back and look at a flowchart and like think from the beginning again.
But the one thing for your listeners, I would say, that's a huge takeaway for checking sodium is just do a thorough fluid assessment of the patient. So what you really need to know before you do anything is, are they hypovolemic, euvolemic or hypervolemic? Because that can save you so much headache later down the line. You do that at the time you take all the tests.
That's the first part of the flow chart, right?
First part of the flowchart, yeah.
Okay.
What's that fluid status?
I think I always used to look, and then I'd go to the flowchart and be like, oh, I have to go back to the patient now because I haven't.
I have to go back to the patient and I have to ask them to stick their tongue out so they can do this trial now.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad I don't have to do that too often anymore. But what did I read the other day? We are all doctors before we are ologists, so maybe I should remember about sodium. This is when they were trying to get us all to help with the crisis, the current crisis. I've totally lost where we are. Okay, what investigations would you consider doing if someone presented with any or all of the above of what we've talked about? And we've kind of mentioned a lot of them.
Yeah, so we've mentioned a few of them already, like you said. As we discussed before, the first line investigation for the vast majority of people is a chest x-ray. So really, depending on what you see on that x-ray, depends on what investigations you would do. And also, as is any with any other diagnostics and with any other workup that you might do or treatment that you might do, it all depends on the patient, you know, what they're like in terms of performance status, what's their function like, and, you know, ultimately what do they want to happen as well. So x-ray is the first line investigation you would do, and then it all depends on what you see on examination and what you see on the x-ray. So if you see a patient, you've examined them and they've got some supraclavicular or cervical nodes, you might consider doing an FNA of those nodes. If you're concerned that someone's got an abnormal looking x-ray or they've got some lymphadenopathy in an abnormal x-ray, more likely than not, in the vast majority of cases, you're going to request that you're going to do a CT scan. Whether you go straight to doing a CT scan of the entire body, you know, neck down to pelvis, is all dependent on initial symptoms. some clinicians do a CT thorax first, and then may do some other imaging following on from that, which we'll talk about in a minute, to further assess. And then again, if the x-ray shows that they've got a pleural effusion, you may then request that they go straight for an ultrasound-guided pleural aspiration to test that for some cytology.
Yeah, cool. What could the findings on an x-ray be if there was a lung cancer present?
Yeah, so sorry, I think I mentioned that in my last answer a little bit as well. But,
well, we're just testing to see whether people are listening, that's all.
Yeah, good point, good point. We're keeping you on your toes.
Yeah.
What we all commonly associate when we're learning about how to look for x-rays in lung cancers, we talk about rounded opacities, and you can see them as sort of ill-defined rounded lesions. As I said, 40% of lung lesions present in the upper lobe, so that's the most common place that you might see them. But, you know, in those more central lesions, you can see them sometimes behind the heart border. One thing that I always tell people to do is, when they're looking specific for lung cancer, is take an extra few seconds just to look at the heart, because you may just look at the heart and comment on heart size, but actually with a lot of these cancers, you can see them if you look very closely behind the heart. And then you may see with a central lesion, if it's abutting a bronchus or causing some sort of lip invasion, as we mentioned before, you may see a collapse. That's why it's always important, and slightly off topic, but always important that when we see people with pneumonias that have got radiological change, we request follow-up chest x-rays in 6 weeks to make sure that that has completely resolved, because if you don't see resolution in that, that is when you would then request a CT to see if there is anything sinister underlying. And as I mentioned as well, you could see things like a pleural effusion, and rarely you can see bony secondaries on the x-ray as well.
Right, I'm going to interject on this conversation now and call it a day for today. I do still believe that short snippets of information are the best. And because my guest is so great, we have much longer conversations. So we're going to pause on Alex for the moment, take away that information, and we'll come back next week with a little bit more on investigations and treatment of lung cancer. So I hope that's been helpful. I wish you all the best in the coming week. So, ta-ta for now. Bye-bye. Oh, well, a dim-bone, dim-bone, dim-bone.